Sahana Vavatu, Sahana Punatu, Sahaviryam Karavavahai, Tejasvina Vaditamastu Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Well, this is a big pile. We'll do some of them. No, I don't think so. I think I'm good. We had one that I left in here. Is that on the top, near the top, you think? Oh, that's what that was.
One. But there was another one as well.
No, that's tiny one. No, I did that one. Oh. The little tiny one that looked like an envelope. Oh, this is the one. Okay, I'll do this one first. Could you please unfold the unfold the Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya? Well, it's just Om salutations to the Lord Vasudeva. But I guess Vasudeva is a name for Vishnu. But the so I don't know what more to say about that, except that Swamiji has done like workshops, and especially for some young people once in Sailorsburg, he did a whole kind of a day workshop on just that one mantra, because it's considered so sacred. And they even say, it's just like with the Rudram, if you were to chant Om Namah Shivaya, which is located right in the middle of the Rudram, or Om Namo Bhagavate, you know, Om Namo Bhagavate. What's that one? No, I got it mixed up. I got it mixed up with Vasudeva. But anyway, there's one where we chant it all the time. that one. Anyway, by chanting that, you get the punya, the prasadam, from chanting the whole Rudram. And that is what they say about Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. For chanting that, it's like chanting the whole Vishnu Sahasranama, which was considered so sacred. They chanted every day the whole Vishnu Sahasranama at the ashram. And when Swamiji was in Rishikesh, when he was, you know, near the end of his life and had maybe a month left or so, they were chanting that, I think, every morning they were chanting it. Maybe they were chanting it twice a day. They were chanting it a lot, that particular 1,001 names of Vishnu. And so this particular mantra, he was telling the young students to chant that, and that you should chant it 11 times, you know, and that it was carried a lot of punya with it. So that's all I know about it. It's the name of Krishna. Vasu, really, one of the meanings for Vasu is that which pervades everything. Deva is that which is self-luminous. So they're all pervasive, self-luminous Lord. There's probably other meanings I can look up, but that one is the one I remember. So that's all I know. But good enough to know how sacred it is, how special it is. Can you talk about the inability to handle stressful situations and easily feeling overwhelmed by stress? Does it stem from lack of trust in Ishwara or our inner children? I'm referring to the work, personal life situations. Well, the thing is with stress, I think we all have experienced stress, but stress is kind of a physiological reaction. When you really feel stressed, it's in your body. I think it's similar to having a lot of anxiety, but it's anxiety of a particular situation. So how to handle that stress or that anxiety? Once it's in your body, then it's something that can often be handled well on a physical level before you handle it on an emotional level, because it's already there in your body, you know. And so one of the things they teach people for how to handle stress, or say if you get stage fright, or when we were taking our exams to get our license to become a therapist or a psychologist, we had to present to a committee of three people. They would ask you all of these questions, and they would give you a case that you had to solve, or give the whole how you would handle that case in front of these people who are kind of just staring at you very objectively, not supportively. So people used to take classes in how to handle the stress of that. Because you would go in very, very nervous, and you would be all in your body. And so there was one person that I happen to know who taught groups of people about this. And what he would always teach is that when you get in anxiety or stress, your breathing becomes very, very important. And so when you get into a stressful situation or into anxiety, one of the things that happens is you kind of stop breathing, or your breathing becomes very, very irregular, which makes the embodied situation much worse. So one thing that they suggest when you're stressed or in anxiety is to start breathing very consciously, very evenly, kind of like when we do in meditation, like if they do it to a count of four, just so that you're balancing your whole the whole system has to come into balance, because what will happen is that your blood chemistry changes when the breath is not even. You'll either have too much oxygen or too much carbon dioxide. As too much carbon dioxide, you feel really sick, and it gets worse and worse and worse. And so when you're in a stressful situation or you're feeling anxiety, to get some control over your breath will physiologically change that anxious state. So that's one thing that I would just do right away if I'm feeling a lot of stress. Because if you don't do that, then no matter what you're doing in your mind, that embodied state of stress is going to be there. You know, so there's that. And then if you have the time to just kind of welcome the stress, which is something so counterintuitive, you don't even think about it as something to welcome. But if you welcome it, all of a sudden, all of the tension that it was holding starts to release. Because what happens is kind of a vicious circle. It's like something's making you stressed, and then you're stressed about that, and stressed about that, and then it just kind of multiplies on itself. But if you just recognize, okay, I'm stressed, do the even breathing, and then just welcome that, you know, without trying to push it away or trying to change it. And then you can say, if you think there's some little inner child things going on there, you can say, what are you really stressed about? And see if it says anything. Say, well, we don't have to be stressed. Let's just relax. And just take a moment to just breathe and to relax. And I think, you know, it's kind of a simple thing, but maybe we don't think to do that. We just get stressed, and then we're stressed that we're stressed, and then we're in the situation being stressed, you know? So we just accept the being stressed. And why am I stressed? Why do I get stressed? So it's just making it much, much worse. So the fact is that you did get stressed. And that's over. You're stressed. So then just say that's okay. You just take care of it with the breathing and welcoming it. And then if you can talk to it and say, well, you know, what's really going on? Or just say, it's okay, we don't have to be stressed. It doesn't help. You know? Use that prasada buddhi. Just accept the situation as it is objectively. And you can bring in your knowledge, but the first thing is to kind of balance out the system that has become stressed or has become anxious. You know, and that these little tricks of how to do that, just working with your, you know, But working with the breath is, I think, really helpful. And then you can do the other stuff. So does it stem from lack of trust in Ishwara or our inner children? inner children can always be involved, and lack of trust in Ishwara. Most people don't have any trust in Ishwara, not any real trust, or in God, because they don't even know what to trust in. Who's God, the God that you're trusting in? So you may have something, but it's pretty blind. It's pretty a blind trust until you really have some more depth of understanding. And then when you do have that depth of understanding, then you can just be present to the situation and not worry about it. So the stress probably won't come, you know, because this is the situation. I just do my best in it. If it works out, fine. If it doesn't, fine. I'm just doing my best. That's it. And I let Ishwara take care of it, because you're doing what you need to do to the best of your ability. That's all, you know. So there's really no reason to be stressed when you have that prasada buddhi. But when you don't have that prasada buddhi and it's all raga dvesha run, then the thing is, in your workplace or at home, you can get overwhelmed. I mean, at least in the States, people that are working in some of the big corporate industries, like the tech industry, for instance, they're working like 12 hours a day and more, you know, because they're being given much, much more work than they can handle, and they're expected to be able and smart enough and capable enough to do it. And so, you know, they're like there from 8 in the morning till 8 at night, and with still a stack there. And so they get really, they're working way, way too hard, you know, and that can mount up. And then they put a lot of deadlines on you, you know, because I know I've had clients like this who are working in the tech industry. How many deadlines are there, and the expectations, and, you know, how to manage. And then the salaries are pretty good, so you don't want to lose your job, you know. So there's a lot of pressure, a lot of stress. And so how to be with that when you're just within samsara, it's all raga dvesha. You know, your job is kind of at stake, your respect from the other employees and your boss is at stake, all of these kind of things that start to put a lot of pressure on you. But, you know, if you happen to be a mumukshu or a jnani working in that situation, it's the same thing. This is, am I going to keep working here? Yes, okay, then I'm working 12-hour days, you know, and I have a lot of responsibility. I have to do the best I can. If I lose my job, fine, I'll go find another one. Like that, you know, because you're doing everything you can, and you know, you don't own the shop, so it's not good enough. It's not good enough. You're doing your best. Home life is a different thing, so that's part of the question there. That, you know, related to like work and your own personal life, your home life. You know, probably. Even Jung himself says this, one of the greatest sadhanas is to have a partner, to be married or as though married. Because that persona is down, right? And so the things that you will say to your partner are things that you wouldn't say to anybody else. It's just your partner, because you know each other, you trust each other, you're not going to leave each other. So some of the things you might blurt out to your partner, you know, some mean, awful thing, you can do that because your partner's not going to leave, most likely. You know? But if you were to say some of the things that you can say when you're bad-tempered to your partner, to somebody you're working with, or somebody that you just have kind of a new, fresh relationship with, you know, that's not going to fly at all. so not this isn't what I'm saying true for everybody, but it is true for most people, for most of us, including myself. People you've known for a lot, you have just much more leeway. And so you become kind of lax in a way in terms of your own like putting your partner as doing that raga dvesha analysis in reference to other people you will do, but to your partner, they kind of don't count in a way because they're your partner. You just do what you want, you know. But that's kind of interesting to see that, you know. So what you might want to do is with the people in your life that are really close to you, you know, is to hold yourself to the same standard. You have much more openness. You work things out much more because you're together, you know. So you work things out much in a much more different way than you do with people that you're not close to. But you know, that doesn't mean that you can yell at them or abuse them, or if you do, you know, you should apologize and that kind of stuff. But somehow it's just not, we take much more license with our partner and with our family because the persona is gone than we do with people that we're not that familiar with, you know. And I think that's something, speaking for myself, that is something to be conscious about, and just to check that out, you know, so that your partner and your family gets to benefit from your prasada buddhi as much as everybody else. And I think that's very, very it's just so easy not to do that in some ways, because you don't have the boundaries there. And so then to be conscious of that is really, really a wonderful thing. And I'm not, believe me, I'm not at all talking about making the relationship super superficial. Not at all. It's just having some consciousness about how you're treating that other person, because they do love you very much, you know. And so they also can be very, very hurt because you're their partner. But you can also kind of take advantage of that, and so it takes a certain amount of consciousness to not do that. You know. Anyway, that's my own experience. But I know that it's generally true. So you have briefly touched on the three gunas, and today you said that sattva reflects the Brahman. Could you explain the three gunas, please? Now, I'll explain it briefly tonight. I'm just contemplating how much I want to explain that, whether I want to. There was one verse where I could have just done that. But to really explain the three gunas and how they manifest, you know, in the form of the creation, takes a while, and people's eyes start to cross. You know, and I don't, and it takes a while. I'll probably take the class to do that. But so I'll think about that. How many people know what we talk about in terms of the whole process of creation with the gunas becoming fivefold and all of that? Some of you know. So who doesn't know at all? So a few of you don't know. All right, well. I'll find a little opening there to talk about that. But for now, let me just tell you that when we're talking about Maya as the what is responsible for the manifestation of the creation, we would say like this: Maya is the material cause of the creation for nama rupa, for names and forms. Whereas Brahman is the material cause in from the standpoint of being. So Brahman is called the don't worry too much about this, but just I want you to know these words are there. Brahman is called the Vivarta Upadana Karana. The Upadana Karana is the material cause. But for Brahman, if I say Brahman is the material cause of the universe, what do we mean by that? Because Brahman doesn't itself become the universe and change into all of these names and forms, because Brahman is changeless, it's free of time, and yet it is the very Sat-Chit-Ananda, which is the very being that universe enjoys for it as its substance, as itself. So we say Brahman is the Vivarta Upadana Karana. It's the material cause that undergoes no change to become the effect. Like you could say, yourself is the Vivarta Upadana Karana for the dream, because you are the Sat-Chit, the conscious being, which is the very substance of that dream, but you don't become the dream. right? When the dream goes away, you're just still there. You're there before, during, and after as you were. So you don't go through a change to become the dream, but you're the self that is actually there. The dream is mitya. It has no being apart from you. You're what we call the adhishtana, the very self of the dream. So what is the material of the dream called? Maya. Because maya is what is responsible for that projection or manifestation. And so the name for maya, so that's for the dream and for the creation. So maya is called the parinama upadana karana. It was the material cause responsible for parinama. Parinama means modification. The manifestation of all that changes, of all that modifies, is from maya. And so maya itself has no independent being for us to say that there's Brahman plus maya. So maya, actually, we can break it down to ya, ma, iti, maya. That which is not, that is maya. Means it has no independent being. So what is this maya that is responsible for manifesting the entire creation of nama-rupa, of names and forms, of everything that exists within time and space, including time and space? So we say that maya itself is made of what, three gunas. So these gunas can be sometimes just three strands, you can say, and each strand is that maya is really those three strands that are working, those three gunas that are working in conjunction with each other. Sattva, rajas, and tamas. So maya is sattva, rajas, and tamas. There's not something maya that has sattva, rajas, and tamas as attributes. It is sattva, rajas, and tamas. And so of these three strands, these three gunas, the sattva is that which reflects or enjoys, whatever word you want to use, manifests intelligence or consciousness. In consciousness is the best. So that consciousness or awareness. And so now say we think of this whole creation as the manifestation of maya, that maya is the material cause for this manifestation of this creation. When we look around in the creation, we say, okay, everything that enjoys awareness, consciousness, in this maya creation, which is mitya, that is the sattva aspect of maya. Like, so that for you as an individual, it would be your sense organs and your mind. That's sattva. So for all beings, wherever the consciousness is manifest in anything in the creation, is manifest because of sattva, where consciousness is manifest. That's sattva. So they say now for the individual, it's only your mind and sense organs, but for Ishvara, the rajas, tamas, and sattva pervade the entire creation. And so the whole creation reflects consciousness. So that's sattva, that what reflects the consciousness. Rajas is what is responsible for motion, for activity, for prana, you know, for the life force, energy, you know, any type of movement is because of rajas. That's the second guna. And tamas is the third guna, and tamas is responsible for what seems like inertness or names and forms, things, you know, that exist within the waking state. So everything that is objectified through your sense organs is due to tamas, the tamas element, which has gone from a subtle aspect into a physical aspect through a process called panchikarana, which means becoming fivefold. And so this maya, which is comprised of sattva, rajas, and tamas, is a model of the creation using this maya, which is comprised of sattva, rajas, and tamas, is a model of the creation which encompasses everything, including the knower and the known, the subject and the object. It's just like in this room, there are all these names and forms, but there are also conscious beings, and there is also this subject-object relationship, right? And so this particular model of the universe is so ingenious, it's so simple in a way, but it also has, it's so elegant. And it accounts for you, and it accounts for all beings, and the fact that they enjoy consciousness. How do they enjoy consciousness? How does that work? And within this particular model, that is all explained in just a very kind of beautiful, elegant way. And so that's just kind of a quick answer. But when I go through this whole process of the manifestation of Maya into the subtle Hiranyagarbha, the subtle body of the universe, and then into Virat, the waking state, and then also look at the jiva in the subtle manifestation of the jiva and then the physical, then there's some really nice and nice, but a lot of them different parts of that model that we have to go through. So just to give you just one little more thing about it so we don't spend the whole hour on it. When the universe, which is comprised of Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas, the Maya, when the Maya manifests as a whole creation, it manifests in the form of the five elements, space, air, fire, water, earth. Whether it's in dream or in your imagination or in the waking state, it manifests as these five elements. But it is Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas manifesting as these five elements, which means that there's going to have to be a Sattva aspect to each element, a Rajas aspect to each element, and a Tamas aspect to each element. And that's how you get the relationship between the seer and the seen, and the hearer and the heard, and the feeler and the felt. So that'll be probably really enjoyable to go through. I'll do it at another time, though. Since some of you don't know, I'll definitely do it. You just have to be really awake. Have some coffee. Okay. What are the enjoined karmas for people like us? For people like us, we don't have enjoined karmas in the same way that they do in India, where when you're born, and say you're born in, as a Brahmin or as a Kshatriya, you're born into the caste system, and you're born as a girl or a boy, and you're at a particular age, or different stages in the life. During all of that, there are really things that are spelled out for you to do, like there's certain rituals that have to be done, there's prayers that have to be done, sometimes some of them on a daily basis, and some they call the Naimittika karmas on an occasional basis, but those are incumbent on you to do those. Those are really your duty, and religiously it's very important that you do them. And then there's very well-defined understandings of how to be a good child, how to be a good daughter, how to be a good son, how to take care of your parents. And the parents have very well-defined understandings of what they're supposed to do, what their responsibilities are toward their family and also socially. So the Indian culture is, it's much more rule-bound in terms of dharma or appropriate behavior. So you actually know, these are my duties. Whereas for us, all of those things kind of exist, but they don't exist as labels. They're not labeled. Like even for the caste system, we have people who are the priests and the scholars, the brahmanas, and just people in general who are more sattvic. We have the kshatriyas, the warriors, and the politicians. They're there. You know, but we call them scholars and priests and you know, politicians and warriors or the military or whatever, the whole military complex. Those are the kshatriyas, and we have the vaishyas, we have the farmers and the business people, and we have the shudras, the people who are the support system for those other people. It's all there, but it's not like if you're born as a if your parents are brahmanas, you are a brahmana. You will be a brahmana. You know, if your parents are shudra, when you're born, you're a shudra. And that's your station in life. That's what you're expected to do. But we don't have, we may be any one of those four. But we can just move freely among them, you know. That's not so true in the Indian culture. So for us, I would say, what are enjoined on us is what is dharma in a given situation. And that dharma speaks to us, you know, if we're at all concerned about being a good person or doing what is right, or there, we know what dharma is. But so dharma is what is enjoined upon us, you know. And really, I would say the golden rule is enjoined upon us. And because the golden rule just speaks to our innate understanding of Dharma. So in any given situation, we have the niyata karmas, the things that are expected of us. And those should come first. That's what I should do. And as a jnani or a mumukshu, that's just about what I do, because that's fine with me to do that, because I don't care what I'm doing, really. I just want to do what I'm expected to do. What's there to be done, that's what I do. Because I'm not running out after my raga dveshas. And if there are motivations, something that I want to do or something that comes up, that's really going to be a non-binding desire, you know? And so you'll do that too, as the creation allows for it, or as your time allows for it, you know? And so, in a way, it's kind of nice that we have some freedom. You know, it's not all so defined for us, but then everything has its beautiful side, its shadow side, everything, you know. Even arranged marriages have some things that are so nice about that, because the parents find a person who is kind of from the same type of background and, you know, has the same value system and has enough money to take care of you. And they take care of all of these things, and then they just bring this fellow, you know, sit him down before you, and then it's true for both. And then you just, by kind of looking at each other, you can't get very close, but by looking at each other, you say yes or no. Yeah. You just feel, oh, you know, I want to be with that person. The thing is, I want to be with that. But it's you, the parents have known that if she wants to be with this person, it'll be okay. And same for the man, because they bring their boy, you know, to meet the girl. And so they have to feel, if my son wants to be with this girl, it'd be fine. So they've all the families are already okay with the thing. But the kids have the final say, you know. So there's something really nice about that, and something very controlled about it, you know. Everything has its blessing. And it's constriction also. How did I get there? Some connection that's long gone. Okay. Yeah. Having been said that without the resolution and having the knowledge of oneself, there's nowhere to truly relax. And in meditation, without resolving, one is basically spinning the mind with silent spells occasionally. It would seem then that most of the world of those who meditate are not really meditating. Is it still useful? That's a good question. I mean, I believe that the meditation that we're doing is extremely useful, but I wouldn't just make a blanket statement that all forms of meditation are useful. It depends on what the meditation is, what you think you're going to get out of it. What if the expectations that meditation, of what meditation is supposed to give you, are false? You know, like if I meditate and meditate and meditate, I'll eventually experience the self and be enlightened. What if that's what you think? Some people think that. I think that's really, really unfortunate, because it just does not work that way. You know, if you're meditating on something that you don't know, waiting for something to happen, then if anything does happen, it's going to be an experience that's going to go away. You know, and it can be even the most beautiful, profound experience that will then go away, and then you have to search and meditate and meditate, trying to get it back again, and then it'll go away again. And even if it stays, then you think, I have to stay in meditation, please don't go away, please don't go away. You know, this is ajnanam. So we have to figure out, like, what is the redeeming quality of these different meditation techniques? How does it help? What is it promising? You know, because it can be really, really useful. It depends, I think, to understand, it depends on what it promises. You know, because there are many, many meditation techniques and many ways of relaxing the mind. And if it's promising that it's relaxing the mind, and it does relax the mind, then I think that's really useful. You know, pranayama, say, is promising that it it absorbs the mind, fills it with prana, and it does that, then that's really useful because it's doing what it says it's going to do. So I would say that's the thing, you know. If it says it's going to give you self-knowledge, then you're not going to know unless you know that that's just not true, you know. It's going to give you experiences and can give you experiences of yourself, but the problem with that is that you already right now completely have the experience of yourself. So what is that experience giving? You are, right now, your being, no matter what your mind is doing, yourself is here and you are not covered. You are completely present. The problem is the aviveka, lack of viveka. So say you think, you believe that by meditating, you're going to have an experience of yourself that will enlighten you. Well, I'll tell you, this is the problem there. The mind already takes itself to be the self. Right? That's the anyonya adhyasa. That's this mutual superimposition. That is already a given. And so now the mind, which has usurped the self, superimposed the self, is going to meditate so that it can have an experience of the self. And so now it's going to maybe do pranayama and do some japa or do whatever, to whatever techniques that are available for it to kind of resolve the mind. And now I, the mind, am having an experience of the self. And that is going to be, what that experience is a shantavritti. A shantavritti that I was been able to, through my meditative practice and meditative techniques, I've been able to bring about a subtle vritti, a shantavritti. And then that gives me a very subtle, very peaceful, very loving, expansive experience of myself. But it's not me. It's the shantavritti. It's the shantavritti experience of myself. It's like the mirror. It's not me, you know. And so then that shantavritti will definitely go away. Because another vritti will come and you're not meditating anymore and then you're just working in the world. So then you will remember that experience and want to get it back. But there's nothing in that little scenario about the self, the one who illumines the shantavritti, or the ajnanavritti, or the agitated vritti, or the sorrowful vritti, you know. Who's that? Who's the me? That me is already present, you know, and so the me, without removing that aviveka, that self-ignorance, that total anyonya adhyasa, that mutual superimposition, is my reality. We're saying mutual superimposition. You're not. I mean, the person who takes it to be me is not saying, oh, this is a superimposition between myself and the mind. You know, it is that. I am that. And so the one who is the mind, this person who is meditating, is having an experience. So that's, and that experience is temporary. And so I have to get the experience longer. You've had more of those experiences than me, and so in the hierarchical scale, you're way up there. I'm down here because I've only, haven't really even had one, okay? And these people say, well, I've had two. Well, I've had five. Well, I have them all of the time. You know, that's just silly. It's silly. But you, that's why we, the tradition says to gain a teacher who can really teach you is Bhagavan's grace. It's Ishvara Nugraha, says in the Shastra, because you yourself don't know about superimposition. You don't know the relationship of the self to the universe or to all beings or to your body, mind, sense organs. You want to know who you are. You know that I'm a conscious being here, but I don't know who I am or why I'm here or what my relationship is to the world or to God. I don't know. All I know is I am here and I want to know myself. But even when you're saying that, you usually, and at least in the West, we usually mean, I want to know my big self. I have no idea that the self I want to know is already here. You know, that's a whole nother thing. You know, so how to know? You know, when I saw when I was 18 that teacher that gave me the Brahma mantra, he was a Very peaceful man sitting. He was wearing orange. It was the first time I'd ever seen orange. And he was sitting kind of like I'm sitting, you know, and very, very still and quiet and kind of talking in a soft voice, you know, and having more, kind of a more of a peaceful demeanor, which most Indians do actually have quite a bit more of a peaceful demeanor than I did or what I was used to experiencing, you know. And so he seemed like something special. And he was wearing the orange and all of that. You know, and then even when he gave me the mantra, I did think it was a little strange, but nevertheless, I didn't know enough to think it's strange or not strange. I was just in this situation, you know, and I was just kind of receiving it and kind of not knowing what to do. You know, it was like more like that. But how would I know? I have no idea what he knows. I have no idea what he teaches. Some friends took me there, you know, and he's supposed to be somebody. And so I have some shraddha. I didn't even know that word enough to go to his place and get the little mantra and everything, you know. So we don't know. So it has to be some karma, some blessing, because it is kind of like a needle in a haystack. There's a lot of funny things going on out there. Yeah. Well, I really trust completely, actually. I have that shraddha that for a mumukshu will always meet their teacher. I don't have any question about it. That's why I really, myself and many of us, I know that Swami Vagishananda is like that. I don't really worry about mumukshus. I know that they'll find their teacher, and I know my students will come to me, and I don't have to advertise for them. It takes care of itself. You know? And that way, even if you advertise for it, still, the people that, because I used to advertise for Swamiji, we made little posters and everything in Berkeley and put them all over the place, you know. And then some 50, 100, 200 people would come. He would give a week long talk, but out of all of those talks, there may be two or three people for whom he was their teacher, you know, or one maybe. The other people got some inspiration because he's such a wonderful speaker and got some insight and all of that. But the ones but there's only one or two that were his teacher. You know. They always remember exactly what the poster looked like. And Edward will always say, "I put that one up." For those of you, if you ever listen to any of the audios we have, you know, online, Edward's always he's always there, you know, he's at every class. Someday you'll meet him. He's at every single class. And as soon as the class is, you know, the talk is done and we say our prayer, he's the first one to ask a question. So you'll always hear Edward. Okay. So Edward has known Swamiji for 3 years longer than me. So he met Edward. Edward met Swamiji in about 1969. Yeah. Because I met Swamiji in 72. He had 2 or 3 years on me. So 69 or 70. Yeah. So he really grew up with Swamiji. And so way back when it was in the 70s. When I was back from the ashram for a couple of years, then Swamiji was coming over. And so he'd always come to wherever I was. We'd always say, I was kind of organizing his trips, in fact. So I would always have him come to Berkeley, or before that, he would come to, when I was in Santa Barbara, he came to Santa Barbara. Steve Nisiborski, you know, Mark, who now is Swami Edwayananda, met Swamiji in Santa Barbara. When we're from our posters that we put up. And then also Mark Berrien, who is Swami Tadatmananda. He was there in Santa Barbara. So there were two of Swamiji's students and a couple of others also. Get her name, Christy. Anyway, there's some of us. And the same in Berkeley. Yeah, one or two. Like Swamiji, when he's teaching 10,000 people, he said there's only a few people in the front row that I'm really teaching. The rest is all inspiration and all of that, but they're not mamukshas, and so it doesn't, it can inspire and all of that, but it doesn't go into your heart and your friend, thank God, it's finally come, you know, what I've been waiting for. Right? So, anyway. Could you please talk about what a sankalpa is and how to set a sankalpa? Yeah, I can say a few things about it. The sankalpa is a resolve or a prayer. Like say you make a sankalpa to accomplish something. That's a type of sankalpa, you know. Or it can also be a prayer, like if you are praying for somebody, for instance, when you will make a sankalpa. Like, when I was told some stories about Swamiji, when some people would always come and ask, Swamiji, my child is sick. Swamiji, can you pray for him, you know? And then Swamiji would make a sankalpa, which for him, it was letting that praying, I mean, just being quiet and letting an image of that child come into his mind, an imaginal image come into his mind of that child being whole and complete and well. And Swamiji would hold that image and bless it. You know? And that's how he prayed. So that's a type of sankalpa. It's a type of prayer. But sankalpa also has to do with a resolve that you set, you know, something that is important to you. So you set that, you just set the sankalpa. I'm doing this for Ishwar Antakarna Shuddhi and for Ishwara's blessing. You know. Then you say some japa mala, or you know, you do something, some prayer or sit in meditation. It's like a prayer, praying for something, making a resolve. There's some kalpa that we usually do. We can teach you that. I very rarely do it, so you can teach it. In the class, when you teach the class, that's regular sankalpa. Dhritikshaya. Ishwarapritiyartham. It'd be nice, some nice sankalpa to before you do your prayers, or if you're doing japa, it just asks for Bhagavan's grace and that all of the dhritta, elimination of all the dhrittas, all of the papa karmas, or all of the things that I'm trying to overcome, all of my raga dvaishas, those kind of things. It's a very beautiful sankalpa. Okay. What I want to do, next we've got 5 minutes, I want us to do the Triambika mantra again for Albert. How's your mom?
I haven't heard anything for a little while, so I guess she's...
Yeah, she's kind of evening out.
Started to eat more, so she's not ready to go just yet.
Yeah. Okay.
At any time, but I appreciate all the support anyway.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Oh yeah, because it gives him. That's what it is. It's Bhagavan's grace. And so, can you give us the current update on Albert's eye? And Albert, of course, but.
He's still in hospital. But the medicine from Germany is really it's working in the sense that that the bacteria is now it's going. So and there's a layer over the eye as a sort of the body makes a sort of a protection, and that's now also going. And I don't know in how much time that you can see how much damage is to the cornea, if he actually can see or see less or not see. And so we really don't know how long he has to stay there and what will happen. But the good news is that he can keep his eye, because that was one moment that he was really...
So now we want him to keep his eye, yes, and may he see.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah.
So when we do this sankalpa, the way that Swamiji that does it is to you just let yourself visualize, you know, Albert seeing with his eye completely healthy, and then like that. That's how we do it. And in whatever way you do it, but I'm just sharing what Swamiji does. And then we'll also have a sankalpa for Sky's mom, that she be so very comfortable and at peace, and that she has a beautiful passing. And it's something that is really, and it's her time when she's ready to go. Yeah. May we all have that, that her mom is close to that. So. You want to start for us? We'll do it for like 10 minutes or so. Okay.
Yajamahe sugandhim pushtivartanam urvarukamiva bandhanan mrichor mukshiyamamrtaat Om Trayambakai yajamahe sugandhim pushtivartanam Urvarukamiva bandhanan mrichor mukshiyamamrtaat Om Trayambakai yajamahe sugandhim pushtivartanam Urvarukamiva bandhanan mrichor mukshiyamamrtaat Om Trayambakai yajamahe sugandhim pushtivartanam Urvarukamiva bandhanan mrichor mukshiyamamrtaat Om Trayambakai yajamahe sugandhim pushtivartanam Urvarukamiva bandhanan mrichor mukshiyamamrtaat Om Trayambakai yajamahe sugandhim pushtivartanam Urvarukamiva bandhanan mrichor mukshiyamamrtaat Om Trayambakai yajamahe sugandhim pushtivartanam Urvarukamiva bandhanan mrichor mukshiyamamrtaat Om Trayambakai yajamahe sugandhim pushtivartanam Urvarukamiva bandhanan mrichor mukshiyamamrtaat Om Trayambakai yajamahe sugandhim pushtivartanam Urvarukamiva bandhanan mrichor mukshiyamamrtaat Om Trayambakai yajamahe sugandhim pushtivartanam Urvarukamiva bandhanan mrichor mukshiyamamrtaat Om Trayambakai yajamahe sugandhim pushtivartanam Urvarukamiva bandhanan mrichor mukshiyamamrtaat Om Trayambakai yajamahe sugandhim pushtivartanam Urvarukamiva bandhanan mrichor mukshiyamamrtaat Om Trayambakai yajamahe sugandhim pushtivartanam Urvarukamiva bandhanan mrichor mukshiyamamrtaat Om Trayambakai yajamahe sugandhim pushtivartanam Urvarukamiva bandhanan mrichor mukshiyamamrtaat Om Trayambakai yajamahe sugandhim pushtivartanam Urvarukamiva bandhanam mrityor mukshiyamam mrityat. Om Trayambakaya Dhamahe Sugandhim Pushti Vardhanam Urvarukamiva bandhanam mrityor mukshiyamam mrityat. Om Trayambakaya Dhamahe Sugandhim Pushti Vardhanam Urvarukamiva bandhanam mrityor mukshiyamam mrityat. Om Trayambakaya Dhamahe Sugandhim Pushti Vardhanam Urvarukamiva bandhanam mrityor mukshiyamam mrityat. Om Trayambakaya Dhamahe Sugandhim Pushti Vardhanam Urvarukamiva bandhanam mrityor mukshiyamam mrityat. Om Trayambakaya Dhamahe Sugandhim Pushti Vardhanam Urvarukamiva bandhanam mrityor mukshiyamam mrityat. Om Trayambakaya Dhamahe Sugandhim Pushti Vardhanam Urvarukamiva bandhanam mrityor mukshiyamam mrityat.
Three more.
Om Trayambakaya Dhamahe Sugandhim Pushti Vardhanam Urvarukamiva bandhanam mrityor mukshiyamam mrityat. Om Trayambakaya Dhamahe Sugandhim Pushti Vardhanam Urvarukamiva bandhanam mrityor mukshiyamam mrityat. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha.
Harihi Om.
Prajabhyah paripalayantam Nyayena margena mahim mahishah Gokamane vyashubhamastu nityam Loka samasta sukino pavantu Kale varshatu parjanyah Prithivi sasya shalini Deshoyam chobarahitah Brahmanah santu nirvayah. Om sarvesham swastir bhavatu. Sarvesham shantir bhavatu. Sarvesham purnam bhavatu. Sarvesham mangalam bhavatu. Sarve bhavantu sukhinah. Sarve santu niramayah. Sarve bhadrani pasyantu ma kaschit durga bhag bharet asato ma sadgamaya tamaso ma jyotir gamaya mrityor ma amritam gamaya om purnamadah purnamidam purnat purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om.